Welcome to the 2018 Fremantle Press podcast series. My name is Kate Lomas-Glendening, and today I'm with the established author and playwright Steve Hawke. Steve's new book, The Valley, is an intricate tale of family secrets that spans over generations. Whilst The Valley is a work of fiction, it leaves the reader pondering the lengths family will go to protect their secrets. Steve, thank you for talking to us today.
It's good to be here with you.
Tell us a little about the book.
Well, The Valley of the book, I suppose you'd call it like a miniature lost world where there's a tiny community of souls that lives apart from the rest of the world for nigh on 80 years. It's imaginary, of course, but it's located somewhere in the remote high country of the central Kimberley. Now, I've been lucky enough to get to know that country really well, and I love it deeply. It's, you know, a world where there's these tiny battling cattle stations set in the most spectacular country with these beautiful ranges and vast expanses of wilderness that have been unpopulated for many years. But above all, it's the country of the mob, the indigenous people, who've never left it, who've never ceased to love and care for it through all of the vicissitudes of the frontier and feudal times. And in the story that I've made, this valley is the secret refuge of the last Aboriginal warrior from the Jundamurra Wars of the 1890s. The story starts in 1916 when a 16-year-old white boy called Billy Noakes commits a murder at a dogger's camp in the remotest Kimberley bush somewhere north of Mount House. And after that murder, he flees with a young woman who takes him to the hidden sanctuary of this valley. From that starting point, to quote the publicist, the valley becomes a ripping yarn, an uplifting intergenerational tale, a mystery story, and a captivating look into a little-known world where things aren't always what they seem. That's maybe not the exact words I'd use off my own bat, but I don't disagree with them either. The book begins with traumatic incidents in the teenage lives of four young men across four different generations, starting with this Billy Noakes. And the fourth of the four is a young fellow called Dance Ajiru, a Broome schoolboy. And Dance, the big thing in Dance's life is that he's haunted by the disappearance of his mother, Millie Ryder, who he never knew. She disappeared when he was still just a babe. And as the story unfolds, Dancer sort of embarks on this epic quest up into that high country, the cattle country, and the indigenous communities of the Kimberley Ranges, where there's family who he's never met, and eventually into that lost world of this valley, and back in, and he sort of travels back through time, unravelling the mystery that surrounded the family that he never knew existed in that valley.
We've mentioned that the valley spans four generations of one family. How do you keep track of all your characters and connections when writing a novel like that?
With great care at first. In fact, truth be told, the first attempt I made to write this story, it became too convoluted and complicated, and I actually had to make a fresh start to have another crack at it. It's only a rare genius who can make that sort of stuff roll out on the page seamlessly first time around. You know, when you're writing it, you do your plotting work and you have the odd false start or blind alley that you have to back out of, and you do lots of rereading. As you get the overall shape of the story clear in your mind and you sort of work out the truth of each of your main characters and which are the important threads of each one of those characters' journey.
So one of the main characters is Dancer, and you've been working on this particular character's truth since your children's book, Barefoot Kids. What encouraged you to tell Dancer's story not once, but twice?
Dancer Jerry was one of the five Broome kids who formed the main cast of the children's novel I wrote called Barefoot Kids, and you know, as you do when you're writing a book, I invented a backstory about Dancer's missing mother, Millie Ryder. And in Barefoot Kids, that was a fairly minor thread in that story, you know. But as I was writing it and when the book was that book was coming out and I was talking about it, that backstory, it became a story worm, as I call it, that I sort of felt compelled to tease out. To make sense of this story that was in my head, you know, I had to go back another couple of generations to the origins of Millie's story. So it sort of unfolded in my head in reverse chronological order almost.
So you call this process a story worm?
A story worm's not actually a process. It's just a thing that gets in your head, you know, like a musical earworm, and you can't get it out. So you're stuck with it, you know, until you do something about it.
So speaking of story worms, you've got a bit of a story to tell us now.
Yes, I'll read you a short excerpt. Lying on an old foam mattress in the back of a ute, Dancer has slipped into a semi-trance of blue sky and wispy cloud jolting in erratic patterns. The hand gently shaking his arm comes as a shock. He works himself up into a sitting position, back braced against the rolled-up swags tied to the front frame of the tray as padding. He grips the side panel to keep a semblance of balance as the ute bounce glides along the track. Riley points. A steep bluff has appeared to their left. In profile, it rises sharply to its peak, then slopes gently backward to merge into the low range that has been sitting to their north for some time. The skyline of the undulating range is stubbled with small white gums and the odd baobab tree, distant yet clear. Riley extends the rest of his fingers. The pointing finger becomes a gentle hand, with which he seems to caress the line of hills. He draws his hand back in a fluid motion until it hovers over the bluff. He begins to sing. After a few bars, he lets his hand drop and uses it to silently tap the song's rhythm. The view is lost as the ute dips into a small gully, but Riley's eyes stay fixed on the point where he knows the bluff to be. His song does not waver. Its pure clarity subsumes the engine noise of the ute, which seems to fade to a distant thrum. Dancer takes care not to stare, but directs his gaze towards the range in such a way that Riley's profile is in his peripheral vision. Sitting cross-legged, Riley rides the movement of the ute like a surfer his board. His face is both calm and intense. Only his lips seem to move. The song finishes on a long, guttural note that sounds strangely jarring in Riley's high voice. A broad smile breaks over his face, but he reins it into a tight, shy grin as he turns to Dancer. Manan Barigu. Once again he strokes the profile of the range from Manan Barigu Bluff westwards to the point where it dips to the horizon.
Family and human connection are strong themes or story worms that run throughout the book.
The story that I found myself telling, in effect it's a family saga. And by definition, a family saga is going to deal with, you know, sort of connections of all sorts between and across the generations. You know, a writer's job is to make these connections interesting and relevant and emotionally truthful above all. And in the case of a family saga like The Valley, the connections, they become like this layered web that echo back and forth between those different generations, you know?
And speaking of different generations, how is writing for adults different from writing for children?
The answer in my case is not very different, actually. Obviously, there's areas of content and themes that you can explore in an adult novel that aren't appropriate in a kid's book, you know? But the writer's fundamental tasks are the same in both cases, in my opinion. You know, you need to create a world and characters that feel true and believable and that the reader can become absorbed in. Barefoot Kids is actually the only work I've written for children. I've written a play and I've written a libretto about Jundamara, the great Bunuba freedom fighter. And these works have arisen from a decades-long collaboration with the Bunuba people. They're projects that I've taken on in partnership with them, and project, you know, the Jundamara play and the cantata that we wrote, they belong to the mob. I'm the writer, but not the copyright holder. And similarly, I've written a non-fiction work called A Town Is Born, which the Fitzroy Crossing story, and that one combines archival research and oral histories from Fitzroy Crossing, which is, you know, the place I call the centre of the universe. And it tells the story of the people who were dispossessed in the great upheavals of the 60s and, you know, their efforts to build a new life. So, you know, that's a non-fiction work that I've also done in close cooperation with an Indigenous mob in which they also own. So, look, and I've written biographies of footballers and I've written social history, so I like to think of myself as eclectic. I mean, I've done all of these things, and now with The Valley I've written the first proper novel for grown-ups.
And what about the difference between writing plays and writing fiction?
Look, the biggest difference is that writing fiction is a largely solo exercise. You know, you sit at your desk. Writing on the stage, for the stage on the other hand, I mean, yeah, you do actually have to sit at your desk while you're punching out the words, but it's a... it's a far more collaborative and community-oriented exercise, you know, that business of writing a play. You know, you get input along the way from dramaturgs and artistic directors and designers and actors and so forth, and there's rewrites happening all the time, you know, up to opening night and even beyond sometimes. And, of course, a play is a creation that belongs to all of these other participants as well as the writer. So it's not a matter of transition between the two different forms, you know, whether that be difficult or otherwise, they're just different beasts.
You've mentioned your work with the Bunuba people. How has your time living in the Kimberley influenced your writing?
In the case of this book, The Valley, totally. I mean, at one level, the book's a big, long love letter to the Kimberley country and the people who live there. The book and its characters exist in that world. You know, the book doesn't really go outside the confines of the Kimberley. I lived up there for almost 15 years after arriving there as a very young man, and although I've lived in Perth since the early 90s, I've maintained a very strong connection with the Kimberley. I get back up there at least once a year, you know, and often many times a year through my ongoing work with Indigenous organisations. So for me, one of the pleasures of writing the book, actually, was that mentally I could sort of re-immerse myself in that world for hours at a time while sitting at my desk in the Perth Hills, so... Yeah, the Kimberley's completely central.
And how important is that physical setting to you?
For this book, the physical setting's hugely important. Yeah, the book sort of passes through Broome, but fairly lightly. Its real world is that high country of that central Kimberley plateau. And apart from the work I've done with people up in those parts, which is what first took me up there, I've now done three fairly substantial long bush walks in some of the really remote and isolated parts of that country. The first one that I did was specifically research for this book, but the subsequent ones have been done more out of love, you could even say infatuation, I suppose, with that part of the world. The book's full of descriptive passages about this landscape, and I like to hope that I've done some justice to its grandeur and its beauty and its power in the way I've tried to evoke it. And there's another deeper layer too. This land where the book is set is lived in and loved by and cared for by the Indigenous peoples who have been part of it for millennia and are still its true owners. And that relationship between the people and their country is something that lies right at the heart of the book.
You have another reading for us.
Yes, I do. Rose's tone takes on a formality, a gravitas that marks this night as different to a meeting or a veranda chat. My Auntie Marge, your grandma, she was a proper rider, a proper boss for this Jimbulawali country here. She was a big woman for the Kimberley, your Granny Marge. All the land council mob, all the Kimberley bosses came here to Jimbulawali for her funeral. Your Grandpa Walker, he's brought you back here. But you got to know your Granny Ryder's story too. And your mother, poor thing. She was one of us. That means you're one of us, Robert Ryder. You've just started to get that story a little bit, but underneath that story is a song, and underneath that song is country and law. You've got to listen now to the Jumba for this Jimbulawali country. And so the night begins. Tim and Riley lead the singing, backed by Rosa and a chorus of women. Two Bob is amongst the dancers, as is Jimmy. Dancer has no idea of the story being sung, but that knowledge can come later. Right now, there is a fierce contentment to be here in this circle, absorbing the song. Riley is transformed. The boyish innocence that seems so much a part of his character has dropped away. There is an intensity to his whole manner and bearing. Dancer studies the dancers closely, watching the patterns and movements, noting the subtle differences to the roomside style he is familiar with. Sitting there cross-legged between Tim and Rosa, he is starting to move from the hips up, feeling the dance. Before he knows it, Two Bob and Jimmy have stepped out, grabbed him by an arm each, and led him up to join them. He is dancing the Jimbulawali Jumba. His new family can soon see why his Nyummy Buster dubbed him Dancer. After a couple of verses, his hesitancy is gone. Once he has the feel, there is a rhythm to his movement that belies the heavy set of his body. A firmness to his stamping with a quick, strong lift into the next step. A sharp grace about the way he moves into each new position. There are calls of encouragement from the women and knowing smiles exchanged amongst the men. He looks up to see Riley's eyes fixed on him. They both break into broad grins without Riley missing a beat of the song. He feels momentarily deflated when the jumba comes to an end. Jimmy escorts him back to the spot between the rider siblings. Tim ties a white strip around his forehead and slaps him on the back. Rosa's gravitas is gone. The twinkle is back in her eye as she asks, "Anybody let on?" I had no idea. She sees the tears glinting in the corners of his eyes and gathers him into a hug. "Welcome to your other country," she whispers, before releasing him and saying in her normal voice, "Get ready for the fun now."
Thank you for that beautiful reading. And as a published author, what advice did you wish you received before your first published?
Get a day job if you want to keep body and soul together. And I'm actually not speaking in jest. It's a field where supply exceeds demand, and as such, it's far from an easy road being a writer. And look, to be completely honest, I don't really have an answer to that question, I'm afraid. You know, sort of everything that comes to mind sounds glib when I say it out loud, so, I'll bow out of giving advice.
And yet you persist with writing. What projects have you got coming up next?
It's a disease. Look, yeah, I am still writing. I'll soon be starting the editing phase of a second novel that I've written called Making Memories that's been contracted by Fremantle Press. And I'm currently working on a short book with the working title of Trailblazers, which is about the roles of Graham Polly Farmer and Bill Dempsey as exactly that, trailblazers for Indigenous footballers. There's another book with a sporting theme that I'm hoping will eventuate, and there is a third novel quietly bubbling away. There's not much of it done yet, but it's sort of sitting there. There's plenty to keep me going, and it's looking really hopeful that in 2019 we're going to be doing two new productions of Jundamurra Sing for the Country, which is this amazing beast of a thing that emerged out of a collaboration with a composer called Paul Stanhope. It's a dramatic cantata that I wrote the libretto for, and I co-produce it for an Indigenous company called Bunuba Cultural Enterprises. So, yeah, plenty happening.
Steve's new book, The Valley, is a gripping story about family secrets which spans generations and reveals the burden the past can have on us. The Valley will be released in October, and I highly recommend you put yourself down for a copy at your local bookstore or online at fremantlepress.com.au.